once you see death and experience it, you live differently, right? Because you've had that window. And I think there's something really powerful about this concept of post-traumatic growth. So once you go through something like that, you grow in ways you never imagined. And there's a positive psychological kind of change that happens if you can get through that. There's something beyond the pain and the suffering. And that's where I love kind of telling our story, because there's so much goodness through that. In fact, there's like a metamorphosis almost.
Hey everyone, this is David Ferrugio and welcome to Dead Talks. Welcome back. Welcome here for the first time, wherever you are. I appreciate you listening. Quick intro for everyone that's listening. I spoke to Shakina Eliason today, who lost her son Lars in 2012 as an infant due to a severe brain condition. Lars lived for only 21 precious days, but Shakina and her husband Peter spent the final 9 days of his life savoring the moments with him at George Mark Children's House, which Shakina is actually the CEO of today. What the George Mark Children's House is, it's a place to improve the quality of life for terminally ill children and their families, just like Shakina did with her son Lars, who was only here for unfortunately 21 days. So this was a really cool and inspirational episode. I hate to say the word cool, but it's always fascinating to hear someone's story who's willing to open up about their grief, especially with child loss, which, you know, that's a tough one. Obviously, all types of loss is a difficult one to approach, but a child loss, that one, I think, hits home for everybody. So please, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for listening. If you know someone that would relate to this episode, share it with them, or someone that might find it interesting, leave a review, as I always ask for. And again, if you want to join for $5 a month on our Patreon exclusive to get these episodes early and ad-free, feel free to click the link in the description. And as always, I'll stop talking. See you next time and hope you enjoy. Yeah, I think the overall arc of your love loss in your life seems like a really beautiful story. And I would love to just tap into that. And I guess, you know, I am interested in the pediatric aspect of palliative care. I think that's really fascinating as it's focused on children and, you know, your story, losing your child. And so if you don't mind, I would love to start from the top in regards to Lars and the child that you lost. And then we can kind of go from there.
Great. And the fact that we don't talk about kids dying very often, you know, it's such an unspoken thing. And yet pregnancy loss, third of women lose pregnancies. And then, you know, so there's so much there that is untapped, and there's a community there that I hope to reach through this too. So yes, happy to talk about that.
Yeah, that is the conversation in regards to child loss. Even on the flip side of the conversation around death for children is also an interesting topic as well. So it's an interesting thought to think about children that are in palliative care and the child's perspectives that are going through it. That's another conversation that I would love to tap into during this episode. But if you don't mind, I would love to hear more about Lars and the son that you lost. So if you don't mind starting us off there.
Yeah, love talking about Lars. In fact, before I was in this kind of chapter of my life, I didn't get many moments to talk about him. I was in the corporate world before and it just didn't come up. And now I get to say his name and talk about him a ton. So yes, Lars was a beautiful little boy, our first pregnancy, first child. He was born in May 2012. So this May, he will be 12. And he lived for 3 very short weeks, but we embraced every day. He was born having seizures, and we didn't know the degree to which he was going to have the condition that he had. So in my pregnancy, late in my term, he stopped growing. So in the early, my 32nd week, we stopped growing. So, you know, they measure your abdomen every week at that point, and we basically were stagnating. So the doctors were starting to get a little concerned. We were monitoring things. He was still in utero, and we induced when he was about 37 weeks, and he was born having seizures. So he was having apnea. He was immediately taken to the NICU, and they were analyzing things and intubating him with oxygen with a tube. And at that point, within about 6 hours, 7 hours, he was born in Berkeley, California, and we were transferred to the Children's Hospital of Oakland, which is a really credible hospital. And we were taken to the neonatal intensive ward, where he was having considerable amounts of tests on his brain, because it did seem like there was a brain condition. And that was the case. He had a very rare and severe case of a brain condition called polymicrogyria, which is PMG. It's a Latin term, and it means too many folds. So his brain basically just malformed, a mutation, and 70% of his brain was affected. So we had this beautiful child, just like basically a day and a half old. And we were sitting down with a neurologist who told us going into the MRI that she thought maybe he just had seizures and he, you know, we can medicate for that and kids can have pretty good lives with that. And maybe that would be the case. But coming out of the MRI, she sat us down, my husband and I, and she told us that he had a very severe case where 70% of his brain was affected. And we didn't know if he could suck or swallow. His very basic, you know, motor skills would be minimal and minimal function. So it was at that point then we started literally levitating out of our chairs. Like we just felt like we were not in reality. And we, you know, stepped away, took some time. And then we had incredible nursing care and support at Children's Hospital. And at that point, they told us to consider this place called George Mark, which I can talk more about, which is the first pediatric palliative care home for children in the U.S., luckily 20 miles from us in Oakland, down in San Leandro, California. And we stayed there with him for his last 9 days where he died. So I'm happy to talk more about that. But that experience, we were never prepared for. We never could have imagined getting that kind of news. And we had some incredible days with him, 21 days, and soaked in many, many memories with him at the hospital, but also George Mark, which is designed for families to really soak in the days and the time. There's so much more to say there, but I'll pause there for a second.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And, you know, what stands out amongst the many things you said is your focus on those 21 days. You know, that's a remarkable thought and perspective that I'm curious. Is that something that you were aware of at the time to be grateful for the time that you had? Or is that something you had to learn to shift?
I mean, honestly, when you're in this kind of crisis trauma phase, you know, our whole world, all the hopes and dreams and, you know, were blown out of our mind. But we also knew that he didn't have a lot of time. And so we thought a matter of weeks. We weren't sure if he could nurse or suck or swallow, just didn't know what he could do. And eventually he was able to nurse, but very minimally. He just was already kind of declining. So when we came to George Mark and we stayed here his last 9 days, this place is a home and it's designed for families to spend time with kids. There are 2 family suites and then 6 patient rooms for kids that are respite care, transitional care, or end-of-life care. And we stayed in the family suite with Lars. And that is when we really were able, my husband, even back then in 2012, he was like, he's Wi-Fi now. We can like walk around with him. And we weren't treating him. We were making sure he wasn't in pain. So the true arc of palliative care was comfort care. And we were just making sure, but we would carry him. There's 5 acres of grounds here with gardens and water fountains and Hummingbird Hill. And so we walked around the space and just had memories with him. He actually was closing his eyes a fair amount, but he would open his eyes and look at the hummingbirds that are here in the beautiful, beautiful flowers. And he would look at them and watch them. And, you know, we really savored that. So now when we see hummingbirds, his brother and sister that came after him that never met him, whenever we see hummingbirds, we always say, Lars loved hummingbirds. And, you know, he's here now visiting us. So we've also did some beautiful hand art with him, his little footprints and his handprints and our handprints and feetprints. And we have art on the wall. We took him in the aquatic spa, which is here for families to go in and have aquatic therapy. And he would just relax in that spa. I honestly thought he felt like he was back in the womb. As he, his seizures would significantly reduce. My husband would go in with him and I would sit on the edge. And we had some animal therapy. They bring in lovely animals here. We have ponies that come. So you were really capturing all these moments, knowing that the time is short. I'll say one other really special thing, the way that George Mark is designed, as families are beginning to process a child that is ailing, there's a fountain and there are these rocks, stones by the fountain. And with the name of the child has passed, and the year on the back, engraved on the back. And when Lars was with us, still alive, I would walk around the grounds with him. And I couldn't go next to that fountain quite yet because I couldn't kind of imagine the finality of that space. But then over time, I was like, yes, you'll have your stone there. And then the families get to take the stone back and we have one at our house too. So again, it's all about kind of beginning to grieve and prepare for it, but also process it a little bit. in the moments that you have.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's that preparatory, anticipatory grief that it seems like a place like that eases you into it, even though, you know, it's never going to take all the pain away, of course, but it does seem like a transitionary place from what you're explaining to me, which seems pretty powerful. And I want to ask you in regards to a little bit more about your process, you know, after he passed, but can you explain for the audience that may have not, that's not familiar with palliative compared to hospice? Because I understand those are two different things. So how would you explain palliative care?
Yes. So palliative care is really beautiful because it doesn't, generally for insurance coverage, hospice care is 6 months or less. A diagnosis with a terminal condition that's 6 months or less. Palliative care is just treating the condition and not seeing a finite end, right? So we were treating the symptoms, we were treating him to care for him. Palliative is holistic care. It's an arc of care without having to foresee a definitive end. Very likely the folks under palliative care will die sooner than later, but it doesn't have a 6 month horizon. And again, in the pediatric palliative care space, as we're practicing it here at George Mark, it's holistic care for the patient, but also the caregivers, the siblings, you know, the aunts and uncles or the grandparents that come. So we have child life therapy, we have social worker, we have a chaplain. So care that surrounds the community that is going through that trauma versus just the patient. And that's really important because after that patient dies, the caretakers, the community is left and they've had some space to process the loss and to grieve and to heal.
Wow. So yeah, so it kind of, it's all encompassing as opposed to, like you said, specifically the patient. It focuses on even the grief aspect as opposed to a clinical medical approach?
The way that we approach it, yes. I mean, I think that the more the technical term, and I don't have a medical background, but more the technical term for palliative is a longer than 6 month expectancy, right? And treating as needed versus, I think, in hospice care, you're not necessarily treating, you're just making comfort, ensuring that.
Got it. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. I just want to specify, just for anyone listening that's not familiar, even though I've had these discussions with hospice nurses kind of talking about the two, but you know, this is a little bit of a different angle. And reverting back to your experience, so after you had this experience at George Mark and, you know, the pre-grieving, if you will, and then having that time with your son, what was it like day 21 days?
21 days.
You said he survived. So what was day 22 like?
I mean, a blur, you know, like grief is paralyzing and it's horrifying. And it was short. It was such a short window. I mean, just going through pregnancy, delivery, and like, you know, it was so fast. You're still postpartum, everything. We were devastated, but we also felt very lifted up because Lars died in the bed next to me. We knew he was definitely declining. And we knew it'd be a matter of days, and he even kind of went in and out of death, which we could talk about. You know, when you're at a bedside with someone dying, you know, they don't die right away. And there's a whole piece of that, which of course you never imagined experiencing. After he did pass, we did bathe him in tea water here, which is another ceremony that we offer to families. And then we had, kind of in a wake, could come visit him. My family came and saw him. So it wasn't like an immediate thing. I always think about families who lose someone in a car accident or something very sudden. Like, it was short for us, but it was not that type of abruptness. So there was some anticipatory grief, but there was also a lot of relief when he died because we knew that it was a better place for him at that point. So, but yeah, we can talk about how my husband and I, you know, we became stronger through it, which some couples don't have that. That's not part of their journey, but we were outdoor people. We went hiking. We actually went to Yosemite and did like a big 3-day backpack trip and spent time in nature, which is definitely part of how we recharge. And that was incredible and just took a lot of time to give space for grief and talk about it. And we both had our own kind of ways of doing that. And we came back together and just processed it with friends and family, which is such a big part of how people, I find, best move through grief is to be in community, whatever that looks like for them. And I went back to work. I had a corporate job and my CMO called me and was super supportive and had a great opportunity for me. And so I took a few months, but then felt ready and And then going back to work, you talk about that. You know, you're pregnant when you left, you come back, people ask you in the elevator, how's your baby? And you have to have that conversation. Definitely happy to talk about that too. And that's another mind-blowing experience. But we talk about Lars a lot. And with our kids now, we talk about him. And I get to talk about him in my work with other families that come through our doors now. And that is really healing too.
What is that approach in regards to, you know, the people in your workplace, the people in your life that know you are pregnant and didn't know you lost a child, and you come back to the real life and they do ask you, how's your child doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's the rawness of the immediacy of it, you know, is really hard to prepare for. And someone gave you really good advice, which was just have your elevator pitch. So just have like a few things that you're ready to say, so you know what to say, so you're prepared for it, because people will ask you, not knowing that the baby didn't make it. And you just basically say, you know, whatever you feel. But I said, you know, my son died. He had a brain condition. He only lived for 21 days. You know, super sad. We miss him. And then those people will sometimes start crying. So you have to prepare yourself for that. And then all of a sudden you're on the flip side where you're consoling someone about your loss, and they're apologizing, and, you know, but it's a real, and it's important to talk about these things. And so even though, as you can see, sometimes I get emotional about it, it's great to have these conversations and to tell people it's okay. Don't worry about it. Life is hard. Death is real, you know, and you kind of walk people off and then the elevator button pings and they walk off and they're like, oh my gosh.
Thank God, get me out of this elevator. Hey,
exactly.
And I mean, that is an interesting dynamic that, you know, I don't think I've had that discussion very often in regards to going back to the real world. That's such a unique, visible discussion that comes about. You know, if you lose someone that's not a child where you weren't pregnant, it's like you can't see it. But when you see, you know, that they're supposed to have a kid, then you lose them, then that's, they don't know, of course. So it's like you're forced to disclose that information. And I wonder if that's healing in many ways, having to talk about it, obviously you could take different angles. You just kind of ignore them, or I don't know. There's other approaches people might take, but for you to, you know, to honestly disclose that you just lost your child to someone, was that helpful in any ways of getting that out and being able to say it?
Yeah. I mean, it's both, right? It's painful. It brings back the emotion, but then you know, you really feel like you're saying the truth, which is important to talk about that loss. And I think about a lot of women who lose their child before the child's born, whether it's a miscarriage or it's a late term, you know, death. And that I always say, gosh, I'm so glad I got to hold Lars and meet him and spend time with him and see his dimple on his chin and all the things that you don't get to, and you don't get to meet your child. And I think that's, in a way, that's almost also another hard loss, is that you don't get to talk about that loss openly. And a lot of women carry that, who've had miscarriages. They know the date that their child would have been born or the date their child died, but there's no space for that. And I was visibly pregnant and then visibly not pregnant. I always say at our baby shower, I had a ton of girlfriends who were pregnant at the same time with me. We'd go to mama yoga together and all the things. And we had a baby shower with a couple of girlfriends all due within the same month. And then after Lars died, you know, the game of musical chairs where everyone is, you know, a few chairs left and then there's one person standing without a chair. I felt like all my friends were holding babies and I was the one standing without a baby. You know, I was like, what the F is going on here? So, yes, but it was a gift that I saw, such a gift that we got to meet him, hold him, and then talk about it in this way.
Hmm. You said something earlier regarding you and your husband, how, you know, you'd hold space for your grief and sometimes you'd go your own way and couldn't find yourselves back, which I think was something I've learned in regards to the relationship aspect of loss. Just in general, like just relationships and grief in general, let alone, you know, a mutual grief and losing your child together. What was that dynamic? What differences did you see between you and your husband grieving, and how did you handle it differently, and how do you bring it back so you guys can be there for each other?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Everyone has to find their way to process things and make the space as they need. I went to a grief therapist and I would go walk in that door and I would just cry as soon as I got there. It was like an agency to go and just like tell my story, all the pieces of it, walk through it, unpack it. And I just found that very therapeutic and healing. And I suggested he could, maybe he wants to go talk to someone. He's like, no, I'm good. I talked to Lars on my runs and you know, process it with a friend or two. And it was just like we had different ways of working through it. And of course, we would talk about him on our own together or not separately. But I don't think he didn't need that or feel called to do that in that way. And that's fine too. And you know, he told me he saw a hummingbird. He was golfing the other day and there was a hummingbird that came like right, like 2 feet from him, was looking at him. And his golf mate was like, and they know the story about hummingbirds. And I was like, what? That's so cool. You know? And so we pull on these empirical moments or such to kind of feel connected, which helps.
Was there any resentment or negative feelings at any point in regards to the differences in your grief process that was a friction that you needed to overcome?
I mean, not per se friction, but I did hope that he was really processing it because he didn't talk about it as much. And I just hoped that it, you know, would be something that he worked through and could, you know, come out the other end. You know, we know grief is not linear. It comes and goes. But just that he was making space for it. But I trusted that, you know, that he was. And I wasn't like, we have to go to grief counseling together or whatever. I just took my path and he did. And our relationship is, you know, really strong. And so I think, no, I wouldn't say a big level of resentment. I just hoped he was processing it in the right way for what he needed.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. And you that's a space of trust, and like looking out for him, but also giving him that space and understanding to find his way, even if that is different than the way you're doing it. I think there's a lot of power to that, and that says a lot about you. So I could see how that could help a lot of people for not taking too, I guess maybe not too much of an aggressive approach, because I could see how it could be maybe, I mean, I can't see because I haven't had this experience, but the thought of, you know, I think the family friction that, you know, I've heard many times is through that the differences and maybe not seeing it eye for eye, and you just, it's a lack of understanding because, you know, there's a lot going on. So I get it. But I think, you know, it seems like you came from a place of trust and understanding.
Yeah. And I will say too that, you know, these types of things, you know, couples either come together or they go apart, right? I mean, somewhere in that spectrum. And, you know, we have very similar values and kind of life views. And we could have put Lars on a feeding tube and tried to keep him alive for and known amount of time. And, you know, we talked to many doctors, had our MRI studied by multiple medical centers, sent it outside of the UCSF network just to get another opinion. And it was like, he has nothing, our son Lars would have nothing to live for. He wouldn't have a good quality of life. And I was grateful that we were very similar in that regard, because that's not always the case either. And we had this beautiful chaplain at the hospital who said to us, miracles happen, but you can't choose your miracles, right? Because some people, you know, and you just, so we just very much felt like if he was meant to stay with us, he would, and he would. So we were grateful for that as well, similar kind of mindset in that regard.
What about the process of having, you know, having a child after child loss? I feel like that's a sensitive topic in regards to when people are ready, if they are scared to do it, or they really want to do it, whatever the situation may be.
Right.
So what was your process of having a child after child loss?
Yes. That's a big one. It takes a ton of bravery, no matter what, especially because we did take some of Lars' DNA and our DNA to see if we had if we had a likelihood that other children could have this condition, polymicrogyria gyria. And the DNA study basically came back and said it was a genetic mutation that unlikely would happen again, but we wouldn't really know until we tried again. So it's like, oh, geez, you know, like, this just sounds like a little bit of roulette. I mean, it was a one in an X million chance, probably. They actually didn't give us probability. So when, you know, we did want to have a family, we come from, you know, family with siblings, and we wanted to have that experience and having kids, and hopefully they're having siblings of their own. So going into that, you know, we braced ourselves a little bit. I'm not particularly a hugely anxious person. I kind of have an optimistic outlook somehow, I think given to me by my parents on life. And so early in, we got pregnant again about 10 months after Lars, and did the traditional testing. And there's a nuchal fold. This is maybe too medical, but there's the nuchal translucency is a read that's done around 14, 15 weeks, so early in the pregnancy. And Lars's read was a little bit high back when he was 14, 15 weeks in utero. But with my blood lab, offset it, and they felt like, you know, unlikely there would be a major issue. So we kept going with obviously, and waited for the next scans, and they were all fine until late in our term. So when I was pregnant with Finley, my daughter, who came next, that 14, 15 week scan, I was quite, you know, this doesn't turn out well. I had no idea what I was going to do. I just knew that was a major milestone. And her read was very low, very much in the normal range. So that definitely gave us an early piece, an indication that things probably would be okay, although a lot of other things can go wrong in pregnancy. You know, it's a miracle when you have a healthy child. It really is. And I know that more now than ever.
Well, bless you both. I was very lucky to have parents like you at this point, because it seems like, again, your optimistic approach shines through the screen. So it's inspiring. I just had David Kessler on the podcast, who you may or may not know. He's a renowned grief specialist. And he talks about, you know, we were talking about survivor's guilt and hope in general. So my point of saying this is to see someone with your optimistic approach through such a, you know, traumatic event of losing your child is going to offer hope to people going through it right now that may have a hard time understanding that. So my question to you in regards to this process and now having a child after losing your first, how do you feel that is shaping or will shape you as a mother today?
Oh my gosh, so many ways, actually. And not just a mother, as like a partner, as a human, as a, you know, just my kind of presence is very much impacted by having gone through that. And then I can tell you more, but I lost my mother 18 months after we lost Lars of stage 4 cancer. So I have two children that came after Lars, Finley, who's 10 now, and Isaac, who's 8. And we talk about Lars a lot with them. We celebrate his birthday every year. We bake him a cake. We have candles. You know, we really honor him and his life and also the impact he has on us. So I think when you're that close to death and you experience it firsthand, you just have this amazing perspective. I mean, some of the nurses that you've interviewed, the palliative care nurses and the hospice nurses, you know, they talked about it so eloquently. Was it Nurse Julie and Nurse Penny? Just about once you see death and experience it, you live differently, right? Because you've had that window. And anyway, so we I think we really embrace life. We lived abroad with our kids. We travel a ton. You know, we say yes a lot to things. And I think there's something really powerful about this concept of post-traumatic growth. So once you go through something like that, you grow in ways you never imagined. And there's a positive psychological kind of change that happens if you can get through that. And getting through that is where the community and the space for it are so critical. And so even these talks that you offer help people, I think, see that there's something beyond the pain and the suffering. And that's where I love kind of telling our story, because there's so much goodness through that. In fact, there's like a metamorphosis almost.
Yeah. And I think that timeline of the post-traumatic growth is, you know, I'm sure there's not a strict timeline for that. So it could take months, it could take years. And that's kind of like the idea of these conversations is that, you know, you're years ahead than someone may, or even some people that may be just the same timeline as you just aren't there yet. And that's okay. But just to see a few people here and there having to get over the hump, more or less. That's what it's about. It's about glimpsing into the future and trying to find some sort of, you know, opportunity for hope. It's like running the 4-minute mile. The first person that broke that, all of a sudden other people started breaking the 4-minute mile. It's like a similar mindset, and that's what we're hoping to accomplish here and through stories like yours. I want to ask you about George Mark a little bit in the palliative care. What have you witnessed in regards to other children that are nearing the end of their life? Are any of the children vocal about their experiences or about their mindsets? Have you seen any consistencies, patterns, or any specific stories that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many beautiful stories here. And so a couple things. George Mark offers stays for children who have a life-limiting diagnosis. So they may not be dying imminently. We take care of respite kids as well. So we have 24/7 nursing care, nurses here around the clock taking care of kids with acute conditions. Many are wheelchair bound, many are not verbal. Some are, which we can talk about. So families get a break while the child is here having a lot of fun. It's really a place of joy and fun and meaning and connection. We've got all kinds of therapies here. So it's not just an end-of-life place, although it is that as well. And then we also provide transitional care. So kids who their conditions getting worse potentially, and the parents need help transitioning their kids into that space. Nurses train them. We have bereavement support, like I've talked about, after the child passed. We have a lot of activities for families, family picnic, pumpkin day, and just support for the families. So it's this holistic care. And then we have neonatal support. So if a mom is diagnosed in utero, we've got support then as well. So it's really five types of care. And the families that come here, especially the end-of-life families, stay in the suite. And the child, we just had an oncology patient here who was respite, a teenager with a brain tumor, and it progressed as was expected. They were given about 11-month diagnosis, and it progressed into end of life. And so he stayed here through the end of his life with his parents at his side. It was a split family. Mom and dad were divorced and were remarried. And so we had just, and then he had a brother and siblings. So we had just family coming and going and surrounding him in so much love and having so many moments with him. And our staff, clinical side, social worker, child life therapist, chaplain, nurses, really got to know his family because he was here, I think, almost 5 weeks and didn't leave. Like when it started to transition, he stayed here. And so we really got to know him. And, you know, he's very verbal initially. And just, you know, his wishes that his whole family would be around him in love and like connecting with each other wasn't always the case in their family. And that happened for him in his last days. But our child life therapist has a ton of conversations with them throughout their journey to whatever extent they want to talk about. They talk about that a lot, especially we have another oncology patient here now who's just in respite, but also has a terminal diagnosis, teenager as well. And they're talking a lot about his death when it, you know, comes up, which it does, or his doctors are telling him more and more it's going to get worse. And she's there, our child life therapist, who is an incredible human, to support him through art, through video games, through bringing in, you know, baseball players who are supporting us and coming in, signing, autographing things and making all these amazing moments and memories for his family. So that gives you just a little window into living with kids as they're facing death. And then we have some respite kids who are so incredible and some who have died suddenly and some who are living on into their 20s, you know, living way long beyond their life expectancy with their condition. So there's a whole range of ways that we get to know the kids and their families, and the families come back. That's the thing.
That's beautiful. What about the logistics? I'm curious about how accessible is a palliative place or like George Mark, for example, or in general, is like, how does that work with insurance? Or this is more for like anyone that's listening. You might know someone that has a child that's not doing well, might not be in palliative. And it's just probably good to know just for whatever reason, but what is that logistical process regarding payments, insurance, and accessibility for people?
It's not the same for adult hospice, first of all. It's not a space in our federal medical insurance system that is as well known, well talked about as it should be. So there's not as many insurance offerings. So if a family, first of all, families never receive a bill for our services. Our founder founded George Mark 20 years ago. In March will be our 20th anniversary. And she was a clinical psychologist and saw kids dying in the hospital and said, gosh, there's just got to be a better way. She was on the oncology floor as a psychologist, and she looked, there were no other hospices in America at the time, back in 2004. She founded it in 2004, but researched up until then, modeled George Mark after the United Kingdom, where there are more per capita than anywhere in the world. But the model is set up mostly through philanthropy. So individual donors and organizations, community and grants is how we get about 80-85% of our operating budget. And then we have a little bit that comes through insurance and regional centers reimburse for respite patients through the state. But end of life, if families have private insurance, there is some coverage, but it's very minimal. And there's huge opportunity to grow that and to figure out models that support that through advocacy, which it was one, we're in the middle of a strategy right now for George Mark being the first. And there's two other freestanding palliative care centers in the U.S. And there's many in development, but partially because the financial model for this isn't simple. In fact, it's quite complicated. It's not. There aren't enough of these. There should be one, you know, within 20 miles of every hospital, right? Because kids die, as do adults, and there's a lot of adult hospices. So that's a big part of our goal, is to figure out ways to support more of these growing, which we're doing to some extent, and also to figure out how to crack the system to support the model.
What are those barriers? Like, what is the reason why it's not accessible? Like, I don't want to be like put my tinfoil hat on, but is this a money thing in regards to why insurance companies or the government isn't willing to make this work and make it more accessible?
I mean, I'm still learning about all the intricacies of insurance and the government policies. I've been the CEO for just over a year, about 15 months now. So I'm learning that. Partially has to do with our licensures, right? So whether you're licensed as a hospice or a congregate living health facility, we're a congregate living health facility with subacute care, which allows us to have respite patients, right? And hospice patients, it allows us to do both. So there's some licensure kind of red tape that limits that. And then there's also just insurance plans don't necessarily, and families don't necessarily want to sign up to agree that their kids are going to die in 6 months, because we want to treat the condition as long as we can to keep our kids with us. And so part of it is that kind of willingness to accept that 6 months is it, so that insurance could cover it. So I believe that's part of it too. And there's more. I have a lot to learn on this topic as well, but those are two reasons.
Yeah, it seems like a rabbit hole of why something like that wouldn't be more accessible. I mean, clearly it's happening every day. So it's interesting. I didn't know the numbers were that low in regards to having this as a resource. So where can people, tell people a little bit more about where they can find either you and or George Mark, where it's located, and, you know, how can maybe someone listening that's going through it, having issues with their kid, or someone they may know, someone to recommend, how people can find a place like George Mark?
Well, absolutely. Love to talk more about that. So George Mark is located in the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay. So we take kids from all across the U.S. We take kids even abroad. Most of our patients come from the California area, and we're referred through hospitals. So we've also working with the Ronald McDonald Houses here in the Bay Area, because when kids go through a surgery, families often stay at Ronald McDonald House in some of the local hospitals. And then when the children are released from the hospitals, if they need respite care, other types of care, we can take the kids for basically a break. If families need a break, the kids can come and stay with us, and parents can go on a vacation or have some time together. Much needed respite for the parents and the other siblings. Our website has a ton of information as well. But I mean, the key point is families never receive a bill for their services. We have a case management team. So we get a referral from a hospital or from a genetic counselor who had diagnosed something, a family with a severe diagnosis. Our case team will take a call, talk to the family, talk to the doctor, see if it's a good fit. Generally, we take kids with acute chronic conditions. And we have a visit. If it's a kind of a respite patient, the caregiver comes with the patient, spends one night here so that they can get to know us. We can get to know them, the patient needs. And then the caregiver leaves the second night and leaves the patient, the child with us, so that we can really get to know them. And then afterward, so it's a two-night stay. We have, and after that, we have a call with the family and the medical team to see if it's a good fit. And then, like I said, families don't receive a bill. We have cafe here where families can come and sit together. Even I remember being here with Lars, and we sat in the cafe with another family who had a baby with one of the trisomy conditions, which is often terminal. And I remember, wow, like there's another family here. And so just the community of that is really powerful. And we are celebrating our 20th year. So I guess that's the other thing I'd love to share, is that, you know, being the first in America leading this kind of mission around wanting more of this type of care in the U.S. We've hosted some summits in the past around pediatric palliative care, and we've attended NWell and other conferences, really just trying to build visibility around what we do and hoping that the movement continues. There is a national coalition of pediatric palliative care homes that started recently through a friend and partner, Jonathan Cotter, which is bringing these like houses together and trying to help more of them form in America, which is very much such important work, because the way that this house is designed, it's designed to feel like a home, not a hospital. So there's 8 beds. We don't want it to be a big center. We want more of these smaller facilities, hopefully, to open and to find funding resources for. So that gives a little bit of background. And I'd welcome anyone to reach out to me, of course, or go to our website to learn more. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary, and we really are looking toward the future, envisioning how do we continue to take care of more kids. We've actually increased our census in the last 12 months since I've been here because we had a nursing shortage, which is real in the medical space. Nurses are burnt out. They were the front lines of the pandemic. And what we're really excited about is how we can help bring more nurses here, build a wellness community, which we've done for our nurses, so we can take care of more kids. And that's what we're doing. So it's exciting.
Well, I commend you for being involved in something that was so intimate to you. I think that makes it even more meaningful. Yeah. So, as usual, every episode, I'm going to plug all your information in the show notes. If you want to find more about George Mark and anything else, please go ahead. And I'm thankful to have you on the show and to share a little bit about this. I would love to take a trip up north. I'm in LA. Maybe check it out if that's I don't even know if that's possible.
I'm so glad you said that. We would be so thrilled to have you here, David. Absolutely. We do. We open and we have tours and we have a lot of work to do to build awareness. We've been this quiet little, beautiful little home that no one knows about till they have to, you know, but really we would love to have you come, give you a tour and anyone else you'd like to bring. We've had a few folks from And Well Come. Darnell Walker came here recently. He's a death doula. He spoke on the stage at And Well just to see the space and we'd love to have you come. So yes, please.
Yeah, we'll make that happen, sir. It's a quick flight, so I'd love to actually check it out if I can, see it, and maybe there's more opportunities to help push the word out. So again, I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story. It was a beautiful story, and it's impressive what you and your husband and family are doing. So I'm sure you shed some hope for some people that are in the middle of it right now or still going through it, and hopefully don't have to go through that themselves. But I really appreciate your work and your words.
Well, David, I really appreciate what you're doing too. I mean, your talks are so genuine, they're so real. Different types of people you bring on, the stories, like I listened to a handful and I was just so excited that you're making space for these conversations because they're so important. And I feel honored to be a part of this.